Good morning, Lagos. This is Dr. Weeba Boor on the show Power Solutions on Nigeria Info 99.3 FM. It's good to be back here again this week as we talk about the solutions to Nigeria's endless power problems, and we don't just talk about the problems. Now, normally on this show, we have people who run companies, we have people from government agencies, NGOs, and organizations that are actively working in the offshore energy space. Today, we have someone a little bit different. He's a partner from PwC, one of the smartest people in Nigeria, and one of the youngest PwC partners in history. His name is Moshood Olajide. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Weber. Thanks for having me.
So Moshood is a tax expert, actually, but he's been working on a project specifically around off-grid energy. And so we're actually going to just tap into one of the many topics he could speak about. So we're going to tap into that bit of expertise and get some insights for you today. But before we go into that, I would like to learn about who you are so that the listeners in Lagos can know who they're hearing from. So tell us about Moshood.
Thanks a lot, Weba. My name is Moshood Olajide. I work with PwC. I trained as a lawyer. I'm also a chartered accountant.
Both?
Yes.
So one wasn't enough?
I think I got confused.
Okay.
I
didn't know which. You're not a medical doctor also, are you?
No. Just but my wife is.
Oh, your wife is? Okay.
All right. So on a day-to-day basis at PwC, I provide tax support for clients.
Okay.
That's what I do on a day-to-day basis. But one of the things I've done in the last 2 years is the project that you've asked me to come talk about, which is about off-grid power in Nigeria.
Okay. And when you work on tax issues, I mean, what are some of the problems that you're looking at for clients? What are some of the key questions they're always asking?
Obviously, everybody wants to pay the least amount of tax possible, right?
Right.
Okay. I'm sure you want to pay just the right amount of tax and nothing more than what's required. But, I mean, I think on a day-to-day basis, the struggle is making sure that the government gets the right amount of money and that the taxpayers don't pay a kobo more than what's required for them to pay under the law. So the day-to-day question is, how do I reduce the tax that I'm paying while still staying within the right side of the law? And the question from the government is, how do I collect more money from these people?
Right.
So it's usually standing in between. At PwC, we like to believe that our objective is to solve very, very difficult problems and create trust within the society. So that puts us in a position where we have to do what's in the best interest of the government and at the same time what's in the best interest of the people.
Right.
So we find ourselves supporting the government in a number of occasions, trying to help them make the process easier for the taxpayer and making sure that they collect the right amount of taxes from the taxpayer. And at the same time, find ourselves on side of the taxpayer, making sure that they don't pay more than a kobo, more than what is required under the laws.
So is this, I mean, as a young man, did you want to be a tax consultant? It's probably not something a kid dreams of becoming. So how did you evolve in this area of expertise?
Yeah, you know, when you started, I said I was a little bit confused.
Yes.
So I started out trying to be a lawyer.
Okay.
And I thought that was what I wanted to do. Then I started studying law, and then I found out that I was probably more interested in tax law.
But did you go through law school and everything?
Yes,
you
I have a master's in law.
Okay.
I have my master's from Columbia University. So in law. So I went through the whole process.
Yeah.
I was in the law firm. I practiced for a couple of years. I went to court.
Okay.
I was actually involved in one of the most difficult arbitrations in the oil and gas industry.
Okay.
So I gave my all to law until I figured out that maybe I should do something that I found more interesting, which is tax. So I moved on to tax.
Okay.
Funny, I started writing my accounting qualification exams while I was still in university studying law.
Okay.
So I was doing those ASUU strikes, and
oh,
I didn't know what to do with my life.
Okay.
And I had an 18-month period. I had nothing to do with my life. So I just said, okay. I saw some people writing some exams, like, what's this? Let's try it out.
The upside of those strikes is actually stories like that happen, right? There's also stories of so many businesses in Nigeria that started when students were bored during the strikes and then came up with an idea and ran with it. So,
correct. Yeah. I hear that one of the guys in Jobberman?
Yeah, Jobberman was started during one of the strikes, when they were at IFE. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, but now let's move on to, so you're now a partner at PwC, and, you know, this project was funded by my organization, but it was PwC that kind of was the brains behind it and all that.
Yeah.
And, you know, you obviously have done a lot of work as an organization in the power space. But what kind of questions do you see clients asking about power, and has it been evolving in the last few years?
So, well, I think we should take a step back and kind of paint a picture of what exactly is the problem here.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
It's been for 40, 50 years, mm-hmm. Starting with the Energy Commission of Nigeria and then former companies that later metamorphosized into PHCN and then the discos. So this has been a perennial problem in Nigeria, mm-hmm. Just providing adequate power supply mm-hmm. to the population. Now, if you go a little bit down the history lane, you will remember that in Nigeria, and maybe up till today, we believe that power is a social good,
right?
Mm-hmm. And the question of paying the right amount of mm-hmm. money for the power being consumed mm-hmm. has always been a social question, mm-hmm. and whatever is a social question in Nigeria becomes a political question, right? So you will find that trend mm-hmm. That has been there since before I was born, mm-hmm. still within what some of the things we're dealing with. So this current issue started maybe sometimes in this political dispensation, sometimes after 1999. So it's been 20 years coming, where the government thought that in order to fix this perennial power problem, there had to be some level of privatization, there had to be some level of unbundling, and there had to be a lot of things that had to be done within that sector.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, we all thought it was an ambitious project, mm-hmm. But I mean, the government has been true to a number of things mm-hmm. they plan to do. They've not been true to a number of things, but if you look at it over 20 years, we've actually moved very, very, very far from where we started from. So I could give you some very, very important examples. As at 1999, the government owned the entire value chain for public power. The government owned the entire value chain, generation, transmission, mm-hmm. distribution. Mm-hmm. And it was a completely inefficient system, right? Mm-hmm. And the power that was being generated on the grid at that time for public consumption was very, very low.
Okay.
After that, the government started an unbundling process, broke the entire PCN mm-hmm. down into generation,
which actually took a lot of political will.
Correct.
Decades of tradition.
Correct. I mean, and at the core of that political will is that question around whether power is a social good, right? And that is one of the problems we're still dealing with today.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
the question around tariff, mm-hmm. paying the right amount of money for power being consumed mm-hmm. today, is still a question around whether power is a social good or not. So the government has moved forward, like I said. So we've unbundled PHCN into generation, transmission, distribution. We successfully privatized most of the generation mm-hmm. companies. Some of them were not able to because we built power plants where there was no gas or where we would find it difficult to buy gas. So it was difficult for anybody to buy those kind of power plants. We've retained the transmission company as a government monopoly, so mm-hmm. it's owned by mm-hmm. the government. And we have privatized the distribution company, 11 of them. I think that's a significant move. What has now happened is the ability to consolidate on those gains. Mm-hmm. Those are the things we're struggling with at the moment.
Right. Okay. So that's the background.
Yeah.
But along the way, in this 20-year process, there's been some kind of milestone policies and regulations, you know, that are actually highlighted in the report we're talking about. So can you give us a little bit of some of those key regulations along the way that have brought us to where we are today? Where, again, even though it seems like the problem is still pretty major, we've actually made progress. And we've actually now also, the market has been somewhat opened up even further to more disruption through regulations around off-grid. So maybe you can walk us through some of those.
So this whole thing started with the roadmap.
Okay.
It was the National Power Policy roadmap, mm-hmm. which effectively itemized the things that the government intended to do. That then became the Nigeria Electric Sector Reform Act, became a law. Because they needed the power, the legal power to do a number of things that they needed to do, like the unbundling and the privatization and all of that. So, I mean, in terms of looking at the last 20 years, those are the two most important and critical documents that kind of articulate what the government was intending to do and what the government has been able to do. If you take that out, there's been a lot of other things that have happened. So NERC, the regulations that have been released by the Nigerian Electricity Regulatory Commission.
Right.
These acronyms get confusing.
Right.
NEC has released a number of regulations, some of them helping the embedded power generation, mm-hmm. some of them dealing with meters mm-hmm. and metering generally, some of them dealing with willing buyer, willing seller, the eligibility criteria that allows big consumers of power to buy directly from Genco. So there's been a lot of regulations along those lines that as we move along, the government finds out that some of the things they had intended to do can really not be achieved within the context. So they bring some changes, and some of them have come in form of regulations by NEC.
So it's constantly evolving, and they actually kind of observe what's happening, listen to the sector, and then evolve with it, I guess.
Correct. I mean, let me give you a very, very important example. So one of the problems that we're facing within the power sector right now is the ability of the discos to actually spend capex, right? Ability to get funding to do a lot of upgrades to their infrastructure. And one of the most important items on that list is metering, right? The abilities of the discos to actually just meter all their consumers. As simple as that is, right, the discos have not been able, a lot of them have not been able to get enough funding to be able to deliver meters to the consumers. So what the government has done is to create, I mean, NEC has released a regulation for meter service providers, which effectively allows anyone who is licensed by NEC, who has the cash, to provide the meters directly to the consumers within a framework that brings the discos up onto the table. So they are meter service providers to the discos, but they have cash and they can. So that's one thing they've done to accelerate metering across the sector, because one of the major problems you would find when you talk to an average consumer of power is estimated billing, right? That's everywhere, and the two sides to it. On the consumer side, he doesn't want estimated billing. On the disco side, they cannot afford the meter.
So it's a bit stuck. So this is a good example of a solution to that. So now, what about on the off-grid side? Because, you know, up until 2, 3, 4 years ago, in Nigeria, the feeling was that all you could do was on-grid power. There was nothing else, even though almost every Nigerian has a generator at their house or their office, which is off-grid power. Within the regulatory framework, there wasn't really any opportunity for it. But obviously, that has completely changed. So what are some of the regulations from NERC and others that have changed that?
So obviously, the embedded power regulation, the even the willing buyer, willing seller situation in some...
Which seems infinitely obvious, right?
Correct.
It actually had to be made into a regulation.
Correct. I mean, one of the things we realized when we started this project is that one of the most understated capacities in Nigeria is off-grid power, right? I mean, if you think about it, everybody has a generator. Like, I mean, I use that loosely, not every single 200 million Nigerians, but I mean, everybody you talk to would have some. Even the smallest, I did pass my neighbor, right?
Or have access to a generator for an hour or two. Yeah,
correct. So that's off-grid power, right? And if you add up all that capacity, it's actually more than the capacity that we generate on the grid in multiples.
Right.
Not just two times, three times, in significant multiples. So you then find out that why are you ignoring that? Why can't you find a framework that effectively optimizes the capacity of that off-grid solution? And I think that's one interesting approach that the government has been looking at. And you then find that the other problem is the ability of the current national grid to actually truck power to everybody that needs power. I mean, depending on who you talk to, people will tell you we need over 20,000 megawatts, some will say 50,000 megawatts, depending on who you're listening to.
200,000
or 200,000 megawatts. The current capacity of our national grid is not up to 10,000, right? I mean, again, depending on who you listen to, if you listen to CCN will bring it as close to 10,000 as possible, and if you talk to other people, they'll bring it as far from 10,000 as possible. But we can all agree that it's not up to 10,000, right? And if you're in that situation, you must ask yourself, do you wait for that grid to get to 20,000 if the government is not going to change the policy around holding it as a monopoly? Because let's be realistic, government funding is limited, right? Nigeria's budget, if you allocate one quarter of Nigeria's national budget to just improving our grid and fixing our power, you probably won't get to where you need to get to based on...
For 100 years.
You then ask yourself, how do you solve this problem in the short term in a sustainable way? And the one of the obvious solutions is harnessing off-grid capacity.
Right.
And the couple of regulations that NEC has been looking at for the purposes of encouraging this initiative. Now, there are a couple of limitations, if I could use that word very, very loosely again. One is that based on the framework under which the discos got their licenses, it would appear that they should have monopolies in right. in their zones. So for example, if you pick Eco Disco, you would expect that for distribution of power, which is a technical word, right, under the regulations, only Eco Disco should be capable of doing that in a commercial scale within the zone that Eco covers.
Right.
So when you then talk about off-grid power, the next question is, how do you ensure that you don't carve out revenues of Eco Disco? That's number one. Number two is, how do you do it in a way that you make the remaining part of the grid still viable?
Right.
Because don't forget, the whole idea of having a grid or a disco network is such that there will be aggregate of uses. So while Lekki Phase 1 will be using a lot of power, Ikoyi will be using a lot of power, places like, I don't know, somewhere far flung that's not using a lot of power, Eco Disco can balance their revenues by getting a lot from one side and not getting a lot from another side. Now, if you then carve out those places and you put them off-grid,
then they make the rest of it unviable.
So those are the challenges that the government keeps trying to deal with to make sure that everybody ultimately has access to power.
Right. So now let's look at this project in particular. So basically it was to look at what are some of the fiscal incentives, which is mostly around tax, that the government could actually put in place to now help more investors and other participants get into the off-grid energy space in particular. And that's you know what you guys have worked on. So maybe if you can walk us through some of what you found. And I think what's interesting is there's a lot of incentives that are actually already there and already available, but most companies don't even know about it. So maybe you can talk us through what some of those are. And in as simple terms as possible, because, you know, you tax guys get complicated very quickly.
So one of the first things we realized was that very interesting that there are actually some incentives that currently exist.
Okay.
Like you actually don't need the government to do anything.
Okay, it's already there.
It's already there. It's just waiting for you. And people are actually just not accessing them.
Okay.
Yeah, because one, they probably are not aware. Mm-hmm. Two, they probably sometimes are aware, but, you know, people just don't believe that things are as good as they look.
Right.
There's this saying that if something looks too good to be true, it's probably not true.
Right.
So people just say, you know what, I don't want to get involved.
Right.
Let me just do my business, assuming there are no incentives. So, for example, there are incentives around locating your business in a rural area.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there are uplifts that you can get from a tax perspective just because you're located your business 200 kilometers away from the nearest government road infrastructure or things like that.
Okay.
So, for example, some of these off-grid solutions in the rural areas that use solar, for example, they could benefit from these incentives if they just knew it existed or if they did a little bit of research.
And so it's not particular to the off-grid energy space. It's
correct.
General infrastructure in rural areas gets the tax benefit.
Correct.
Okay. Correct.
Right. And there are other incentives around when you build capacities that are located in places where those capacities do not exist from the national grid. Those infrastructure you could get some tax rebates, some tax uplift.
Okay.
As a result of those.
And did you get any sense? Are any companies actually looking for applying for those now, or mostly they're just people aren't aware of them?
Most of them, people are not aware of them.
Okay.
The interesting thing is that the companies that are aware of them are the big companies. So you would almost think that the guys that don't need it are the guys that know it exists, and they're the guys that are using it. The guys that need it actually do not know these things exist. So from our perspective, just the government engaging and publicizing these things. And, and that's why we found the work we did very, very interesting, because it was more or less an avenue for us to harness some of these things and put them in a document so that people can easily access them. And
because when we first started talking about this, our assumption was there was nothing out there, and it would all have to be new and, you know, things that would have to be implemented. But your team actually showed that there's a lot that's there waiting to be used, and it's just not being used.
Correct.
So now, you know, and just so the listeners know, this report is called, it's basically for fiscal incentives to unlock the off-grid energy sector. You can get it on the All On Twitter handle. It's at All On Energy. You can also get it on our website, which is www.all-on.com. So if anyone is interested in reading it there, it's a great report that summarizes both the sector and the policies and regulations, but then specifically around these incentives. Okay, so then now what were some of the areas that you had to highlight that aren't yet in place, but that it was kind of strategic for the government to consider putting these things in place to, again, increase the investment in this off-grid space.
So you will find that a lot of the off-grid solutions are renewable energy, mm-hmm. a lot of them. So what we thought was that if the government could give as much incentives as it currently gives to fossil fuel-based mm-hmm. Generating capacity, mm-hmm. so renewable energy generating mm-hmm. capacities, then you would actually encourage off-grid okay. energy.
Okay. So it's the same incentives that are already out there.
They're already out there for gas, for example. Right. So okay. there is incentive. So if you're bringing in gas-powered generators, mm-hmm. right, turbines, that would use Nigerian gas, you wouldn't pay import duties, okay. you wouldn't pay VAT, import VAT.
Mm-hmm.
These are significant incentives. So mm-hmm. that brings your cost down by sometimes as much as 15%.
Right.
Right. right. So that's a huge cost. If you mm-hmm. if you just extended that to mm-hmm. renewable energy solutions, mm-hmm. you will find that you will get more off-grid energy solutions in the rural mm-hmm. areas that you currently get right. because you reduce their cost, their right. capex on day one.
And so that particular example, what is the process that then that would have to be changed? Is it that it has to go through the National Assembly as a bill, or it's something that can be, you know, maybe added as a appendix to a current legislation or something like that? How does that happen?
So the VAT and the import duty is one. Do not necessarily have to go to the National mm-hmm. Assembly, particularly the VAT. The law allows the government to, by an order, basically okay. Amend the list of exempt items.
Order like from?
From the president.
Okay, so right. still, okay.
Yeah, so, okay. but that doesn't have to go through the National Assembly.
Right,
so,
right.
I mean, in the last 3 weeks or thereabout, the government issued an order exempting mm-hmm. some items from VAT. So, it's
okay.
that,
okay.
Well, things are not that simple in Nigeria, but
it's doable.
It's doable, process, yeah, that's the right word, yes.
Okay, so that's one. So, what are some of the other examples?
I mean, the biggest ones are the VAT and the import duty exemptions. Mm-hmm. There is the pioneer status, which okay. is a tax holiday from income tax for mm-hmm. 5 years, 3 years initially, and then mm-hmm. potential to add 3 years onto it.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that doesn't really require any significant amendments.
Right.
Current off-grid solutions can benefit
and
from...
some are already benefiting.
I think
the issue on that one, though, is the typical off-grid company needs 7 years or so to recoup their investment.
Correct.
So the recommendation there was more that timing should be extended. And again, what's the process for that to happen?
So for that to happen, this has to go to National mm-hmm. Assembly because this requires an amendment to the legislation
So it's not that the NIPC can just do it on their own and extend it.
No, they can't.
Okay.
So this is a more difficult, if I can use that word, to achieve recommendation than the other ones that do not require the consent of the National Assembly, because you know when we say something requires National Assembly, it has to go to the two houses,
right
okay. and our success rate in Nigeria in terms of bills going through the two National Assembly is not
right. It's quite difficult.
Yes.
Okay.
Difficult, yes.
All right, so now the report also included some disincentives,
correct,
for the diesel and petrol generator sector. So how could that work?
So, I mean, the way we had thought about it is that for you to encourage renewable energy solution, and this is in line with the policy of the government with respect to diversifying the source of energy within the country, you are in a situation right now where it's almost cheaper and faster for you to get dirty fuel, if I could use that word, to power your equipment now than for you to use renewable energy. So for you to kind of move people towards renewable energy, you kind of have to put some level of disincentive on dirty fuel, if I could use that word. So
now we have a subsidy on all and the actual fuel itself.
Yeah.
Right?
What's interesting is that a bottle of water,
mm-hmm.
right, in Nigeria
mm-hmm.
is cheaper than a bottle of fuel.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Sorry, a bottle of fuel
is cheaper.
It's cheaper than the other way around. Yeah. A bottle of fuel is cheaper than a bottle of water in Nigeria.
Right.
So that shouldn't sound right, right?
Right.
I mean, nobody should tell you about the economics, right?
Right.
It just does not sound right that
you
think about it that way. So I think that there has to be some conversation around disincentivizing this fuel. And one of it is just as simple as removing subsidy, right?
Right.
Something as simple as
complicated,
but
still complicated.
Yeah, very, very, very complicated. Right. But again, you go back to this fundamental question around what is social good in Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
Should PMS be a social good? Mm-hmm. Should power be a social good? Mm-hmm. Should all of these things be a social good? And if we all collectively agree that they should be a social good, then we keep the subsidies, we keep everything the way it is.
But if we want to really address the power problem and fix it, then it can't be seen that way.
Correct. Because I don't know anywhere in the world that has our kind of population that we still treat power fundamentally as a social good.
Okay. Well, good. Thank you very much. I think, though, before we go on, I would like to just ask a question. So now you finished the report.
Correct.
So what is your recommendation to us and to other players in the space, the industry associations and so on, in terms of how to now take this report and distill it and get it done, get it, passed through government? What do we need to do?
So there are two or three elements to that. The first element is just making sure that some of the things that are just easy to achieve, right? Or some of the things that currently exist that people don't know about, just make sure that people get to know about it.
Okay, awareness.
So that's very simple, awareness. Yeah. The second is supporting the government, because a number of these things that we're talking about are actually aligned with the objectives of the government. So just...
they just haven't thought about it in this way.
Correct. So just engaging them, sensitizing them.
So it's not an us versus them. They'll probably be the partners.
Correct. Because a lot of the things we talk about here are the things we hear them talk about when they talk to us about the problems they're trying to solve.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a us against them situation. It's actually us trying to solve their biggest headache.
Right. Right.
Any government in Nigeria that is able to guarantee transfer our power supply is probably going to remain in government for a long time.
Right. Yeah. And if they can't?
Yeah, it's a problem.
So now, you're obviously, this is one piece of work, and you've probably been part of other work, and you hear about what's happening in your firm around the power sector. Do you have hope? Do you think that in 3 to 5 years we're going to be having a very different conversation? Or do you think we're still going to be where we are?
I think that we will be in a different place. How far along that path would be is what I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, some of the quick wins are very difficult for the government. Mm-hmm. It requires political will.
Mm-hmm.
So, cost-reflective tariffs remain a very, very fundamental requirement to make all of the things we're talking about work.
Right.
So even off-grid power might not survive if the tariffs are not cost-reflective.
Right.
And you find out that where off-grid power solutions have worked in Nigeria, in most instances, people are comfortable paying just a little bit more than what they're paying.
Or a lot more, actually.
Or a lot more. Yeah, so yeah. There's a market in the east that the VP was talking about.
Area
market. Yeah. I mean, they're paying a lot more, and they have power, and they're happy. So
yeah.
I would pay more if I was going to get in for our power supply. By the way, I currently pay more because I buy diesel. So
we need to get you to stop buying diesel. Okay. All right. So the future is looking bright.
Yes, I guess.
The future is looking bright. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Our time has already run out. So this has been a great conversation, and I hope the listeners learned a lot, especially anyone listening who's already running a company in this space, and what incentives you already have access to, and then how we can work together to drive some of these other things. So thank you very much, Moshood, for coming in. Even though you're a lawyer and a tax guy, you actually made it all very clear and easy to understand. And I think the listeners learned a lot today. So thank you very much for coming on. And Lagos, have a great day, have a great week, and I look forward to being back next week to talk about power solutions on Nigeria Info 99.3 FM.
Thank you very much.
Information at its peak. This is 99.3 Nigeria Info. I'm listening.
We are 99.3 Nigeria Info, the talk station of the nation. Let's talk.
99.3 Nigeria Info. We'll be right back.
Hotel Expo Nigeria is West Africa's premier annual exhibition, sales and concert for the hospitality community. Come experience the latest hospitality trends, B2B, networking, and technology and security, lighting, interior and design,
transportation and travel,
as well as the finest hotels. Date, 9 to 10th of May 2019. Venue, the landmark event center, Victoria Island, Lagos, Nigeria. For exhibition and sponsorship, please call 090-9000-7835 or visit www.hotelexponigeria.com. Hotel Expo Nigeria. Discover hospitality.
Media partner, Nigeria Info.